As a business owner, it's important to keep your business connected. Spectrum Business is committed to keeping your business online whenever and wherever you need us, all backed by the Spectrum Commitment. Get fast, reliable internet starting at $40 per month when bundled, or level up your internet speed and get a 3-year price guarantee. Learn how Spectrum Business can help your business stay connected at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus tax, for a limited time and subject to change. Max 1 offer per account.
Some people follow the rules, I break them. I'm Soraya, and on Rule Breakers, we talk to the rebels who do things their way. Listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
6:13, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Good Friday, April the 18th, heading into the Easter weekend. Today, warmer than it was yesterday. It was a little toasty outside yesterday. You know, I got Teddy the puppy, but he's solid black, and it's amazing how quickly that fur picks up and absorbs the heat. I mean, he's out in the sun for like a minute, and you can fry an egg on his back. It'd be a little hairy, but, you know. Anyway, highs of 84 today, 83 tomorrow with clouds. Then Sunday, Easter Sunday, highs of 82 and cloudy. But the good news is dry, no rain until Monday as it stands now. And then next week, we'll be into the upper 70s, 80s, maybe a chance for showers throughout the week. So we'll see how that plays out. You know how this show works. You come in with a skull full of mush, and if you survive, you leave thinking like a lawyer. Mr. Schultz, stand up and give us the facts of the case with Trump and the Supreme Court. I'm just kidding. David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. How you doing, David?
I am doing great, but I guess happy Easter in advance of it.
Yeah, let me annotate that bit just now, because for those that don't know, that's from the paper chase with John Houseman, and the millennials can Google it to see what the hell I was talking about. Now, let's move on to real life. Sometimes one case can change a nation, where it involves one person, and if you look at Miranda, right, what happened with him, with the Miranda rights, if you look at what happened with the integration of schools and what happened there, New Orleans had a hand in that. So when it comes to the person that the Supreme Court, or not the Supreme Court, that President Trump's administration sent to El Salvador, that's prompted some court action. And tell us, if you will, David, and seriously, about the facts of the case, tell us how we got to where we are and where the Trump administration is with court orders, et cetera.
Well, as we know, the Trump administration, or Trump, said that he wants to deport lots of people who are illegal in the United States. They did a roundup several weeks ago of individuals, and including in that group of individuals was a person who was deported, even though he had no criminal record in the United States. And these deportations were occurring without hearings, which are required under our U.S. Constitution. Like, this is not the movie Casablanca, where you just round up the usual suspects. It's supposed to be you have hearings, you make determinations, and then before you can take any kind of action. So anyhow, he rounds up this individual along with others, puts him on a plane, is challenged, and the judge orders and says, hey, you can't deport these people without some type of a hearing to determine whether or not what you're doing is legal or illegal, or whether that person deserves to be deported, and orders the government to turn the planes around. It appears now, according to all the facts, that the Secretary of State and the government disregarded what the order was to bring them back, and then the judge has said, well, what I want you to do now is to give me daily reports on bringing this person back to the United States. I want you to do everything you can. And the simple answer is that it does not look like the Trump administration is cooperating and disregarding. And so now we're getting to the point right now where it looks like the Trump administration has basically, given its, has basically
middle finger.
I'm trying to decide if I can say that. The middle finger, to the judge. And the judge is now saying, we are contemplating contempt of court against individuals in the Trump administration. This is not just about one person. This is about a broader issue about the Constitution, due process. It's about the right of people to have hearings before the government just rounds you up. And that's why this is such a significant case, because it's one person, but it's about a broader principle.
That's why I, if I might say so, David, brilliantly started it with Miranda and the integration of schools, where it starts with one case and then it stands and then it changes, or it leads to a big national confrontation, if you will. And here's what I'm trying to get to, and I'm kidding about being brilliant, but to me, this, we got two railroad tracks here that are heading toward each other. One is President Trump and executive orders and what he wants to do. And the other is the court system and the Constitution. And at some point, it's going to lead to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but at some point, it's going to lead to the Supreme Court either backing President Trump and unlimited executive orders or standing up for the Constitution. Am I being overly dramatic or not?
I don't think you're being overly dramatic, because what I would teach in my law school classes going back to 1776, first as well, we are a country that hated and was born of hating and fearing strong central power. We hated kings. We hated royalty. We said, no, we want a limited government. And the government we created in 1787, our Constitution, all of us know the words. Checks and balances, separation of powers. We eventually came to adopt the idea that at the end of the day, the courts get to make the call on whether things are constitutional or not. This is about as, I could call it like American politics or constitutional law 101. Mm-hmm. It's the basics. And even if a lot of listeners out there say, I still don't care about this guy, well, it's about the basic idea that if the government stops us, or suspects us of doing something, they're supposed to give us a hearing. They're supposed to carry the burden of proof to prove we're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, as we saw on all the television shows we watched with cops and robbers. It's about, again, as I say to my students, the most basic of bedrock principles about what it's supposed to be in a free society in the United States.
And that's, thank you for saying that, because that's the point I was trying to make. It's not about this one guy. It goes a lot bigger than that, and a lot, it means a lot more than that. So, first of all, for those that are President Trump's fans and think that I'm knocking him, I'm not. If I were President Trump, I'd do the same thing. If I was the president and I had a view of the country and I would let me go as far as I go, I'd keep pushing it till they told me to stop, because that, I guess, the power of the Oval Office and bully pulpit, whatever you want to call it, is massive. However, also as a citizen, I'm concerned that this president might set precedents that the next president, and if you're a Trump fan, you got to be aware of this, that, next time it might not be your guy or your woman that's in office, and maybe President Trump establishes some powers for a president that you don't want the next president to have. And I'm just trying to look at it in the bigger picture and take it out of a political context. That's accurate, is it not?
I think it's accurate, and I'm going to put it even in a longer perspective. We have probably, over the course of 250 years, and I'm going to say at least since, let's say at least since the middle of the 20th century, given too much power to the presidency, regardless of which party it is. There was a famous historian, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., back in the 1960s or 70s, wrote a book called The Imperial Presidency. And I think that book has turned out to be really correct, where he wrote back then, 60 years ago, he said, hey, I'm warning you folks, we're giving too much power to the president. And if we ever learned anything, what's that old adage? Power corrupts, mm-hmm. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And he said, we got to figure out a way of decreasing some of the power that we're given to the president. And a lot of it has happened because my words, not his. I always say to my students, because Congress is full of a bunch of weasels. And what I mean by that, Congress keeps saying, well, we don't want to do it. We'll kick it over to the president. We don't want to do it. We'll kick it over to the president like that. And we keep kicking all that stuff, the tough decisions over there. What are you eventually going to get? A too powerful of a president. And that's where Trump is now. He is kind of, I don't know, I'm looking at the apex, the top of a pyramid. I'm not sure what a metaphor I'm looking for, but he is the product in part right now of too much power that we've given to the presidency. And
you know, I'll put it in this example, and this might be an accurate way. It's kind of like the rules of golf. Sometimes they favor you, sometimes they don't. The president is going by whatever hole there is in the rule book right now and saying, all right, now I'm going to move the ball wherever I want it to be, and I'm going to keep doing it until you tell me to stop. Some texts that are coming to Oakland Art Jeweler talking. Text line 504-260-1870. Text, data, and message rates apply. Please don't text and drive. And David, you can respond to all of this. Also ask you yes about the latest issue that Trump wants to deport U.S. citizen lawbreakers, which is totally against the Constitution. Another text says he's an illegal immigrant. And again, the issue is more than about this one guy. Another text says, I don't understand the statement. He or she was here illegally but did not have a criminal record and was deported. What if I don't have a criminal record and get pulled over for DUI and brought to jail? Should I not be brought to jail because I didn't have a criminal record? I'm not pro or con Trump. I just don't understand the logic. And then somebody else said, of course, it's always comes back to the same thing, like when Biden ignored the Supreme Court. And you can address when this has happened previously and what happens if the president ignores the Supreme Court. 6:22 and a half, traffic now, WWL. 6:27 and a half, Tommy Tucker. Quickly back to David Schultz, professor of law and political science, our friend, our guest at Hamline University. David, you read the text or you heard the text that I read before. You want to respond to which ones? Go ahead. David, you there? You got me muted? David might be reading the screenshot of the text I sent him and has me muted. David? David Schultz, do you have me on mute? David, you there? David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. The texts were about the president and the Supreme Court. As somebody said, ask your guest about the latest issue that Trump wants to deport. Huh? David, you there? Okay. Well, you know what we're going to do? Since David's not there, and we had an interesting conversation going, whenever we have technical issues, sometimes I have to call an audible. Remember when Drew Brees used to say kill, or Peyton Manning used to say Omaha? I'm going to call an audible right here. We're going to do a quick version of what? Right now what?
Right now
he might be on. What the hell does that mean? David, are you there?
I'm there. For some reason, it went dead silent. I couldn't get any. We were connected, but dead silent.
Yeah. We got a minute left. Wrap it up.
Okay. Right. Okay. Okay. So where we want to wrap it up at this point is I want to do an example, is that even though somebody might be illegal in the United States, they're still entitled to their day in court. I have a friend or somebody I met recently who represented the person who tried to assassinate Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s. And even though that was caught on tape. No, that was like Mark David Chapman or somebody like that.
Reagan, I got you.
Yeah. But the point being is that even though everybody saw it on tape, that person was still entitled to what, a hearing, and for the government to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what's really going on here. It's that broader point, is that the government in a free society, supposedly as ours, bears the burden of proof. And even though you're accused of doing something illegal, even though you're accused of being maybe not in the United States legal, you have your right to a hearing in court to explain and force the government to prove its case.
So bottom line is, if there's no due process, you don't really have a way of proving you're a citizen. The government can just say you're not, and that's it, right?
Exactly. That's the problem.
All right. Thank you, David. Appreciate your time. We'll take a break. Come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. All right, 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Man, an exciting game for LSU baseball last night. Here to tell us more about it, Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I'm good. Y'all ready for the Easter weekend?
I think so. Yep.
Big family gathering. Like what you guys got planned?
Not much. It's this late Easter. It's just crazy. Before we know it, it's going to be Memorial Day. It's just very weird to have it this late.
Real quick, before we get to LSU baseball, I'm thinking about changing the name of my dog, who's been named, he's been through two names already, and I think I finally found a right name for him. Have you ever changed the name of a pet or not, or do you think that's acceptable?
No, I have not. I have not done that.
Kids are different. Pets, I think I got a couple of months leeway on this. Anyway, let's talk about LSU and Alabama last night.
Man, what a game last night, Tommy. It, you know, it was one of those classic games at the box where, man, you know, the first few innings just not going well. The other team builds up a lead. And why I say it's one of those classic games at Alec Box Stadium, we've seen it so many times that once LSU is able to turn the momentum in its favor, they just run away with it. And last night was a perfect example of it. Scoring 10 unanswered runs. They are down 5-1. It's looking bleak. Even Jay Johnson getting a little desperate, going with Josh Pearson, and gets the big pinch hit, single. And then he pinch hits Ashton Larson. Larson was someone that played a lot last season as a freshman, especially in SEC play, made the freshman All-American team. But this year, he's been riding the pine. He's only got one at-bat in SEC play, and that came last weekend, heading into last night's game. And what does he do? He rewards Jay Johnson and his teammates by smoking a three-run homer, gets LSU within one run. And then in the next inning, LSU hits another three-run homer. Steven Milam gives LSU the lead, and then with the way Cason Evans has been pitching, you can't mount any rallies against this guy. He's been nearly perfect this season as a freshman. He does the job, ends up being the winning pitcher, and just a great game. You get an Alabama assistant coach who gets tossed for arguing a what should have been ball four. Justin LeBron should have walked there for Alabama, and that would have loaded the bases after LSU got within one run. He strikes out. And then LSU gets another call prior to the Steven Milam three-run homer. Jared Jones should have struck out. Instead, he walks on a pitch that looked like it hit the outer half of the plate. He walks. That sets up Milam's three-run homer. So it just unraveled for Alabama. And again, once that momentum really swung in LSU's favor, once again, another opponent just doesn't have a chance at Alec Box Stadium once that momentum and the crowd really gets into it. Like it did last night, they didn't have a chance.
I don't want you to say anything wrong here on the air, okay? But generally speaking, is there one line? Is it a cumulative effect, or is there one line that a coach crosses that'll get him tossed?
Well, I don't blame him for getting tossed.
No, I'm not either. I'm just wondering what it is that's what's the tipping point.
And if you notice, he really and I. At first, the home plate umpire allowed the verbal beating from the first base coach from Alabama. And it wasn't until he had walked away from him, you know, because he's at the first base coach's box. Justin LeBron strikes out on a pitch that looks very low. And even Cason Evans admitted it after the game. He didn't think – and you could tell by Cason Evans' reaction. I mean, usually when you strike out a guy – with runners in scoring position late in the game, you run off the mound and you're excited and you're pumping your chest and you're firing up your teammates. Cason Evans was like, what? Okay, that's strike three. I'll just walk back to the dugout. So, but the Alabama first base coach, he was really fired up, and I don't blame him. It was a crucial moment in the game. Alabama was trying to get the momentum back in their favor after Ashton Larson hit that three-run homer. They had their best hitter at the plate. That should have been ball four. It should have been bases loaded for Alabama at that point. Instead, it's strike three. The LSU fans are going crazy. So the Alabama first base coach, as he's going back to the first or third base dugout, he's got a long time there to just get into the umpire, just scream at him. And that's what he was doing. And it wasn't until he had walked like 10 feet past him that the home plate umpire finally ejected him. So I think in a way, just the way it would look, the umpire realized that he missed the call, and so he allowed the first base coach to have a say. But when he kept talking as he went towards the dugout, and then obviously he said some sort of magic word, And then that was it.
Oh, there's again, nothing.
That just motivated the LSU team even more. I think it was Ashton Larson that said that. It might have been Ashton Larson or Cason Evans, one of the two, said that last night, that when the coach got ejected, that got the team even more fired up.
There's nothing that'll get anybody, some people, angrier than when they make a mistake and you call them out and you continue to call them out and they can refuse to admit that they made a mistake and they keep backing themselves into a corner and the only out they have is to react angrily, which is probably what the umpire did. I've always wondered, though, like you're talking about, is it something a guy says when he's got his back turned? Does it turn personal? Is it about the mother? Is it about the wife or something? You understand what I'm saying? Proclivities.
Yeah.
I just always wonder what that tipping point is. Or maybe it's just a cumulative effect. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back talking LSU baseball with Jeff Palermo. 6:51, 9 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7. Thrilling LSU victory last night on a diamond at the box. Jeff Palermo, WWL.com. Columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, joins us. Jeff is excited and as happy as I am about the win. Let's talk about Cade Anderson, if we can.
Yeah, you know, not his best performance, right? I mean,
and coming off of the right, wasn't he the performance with the 100-something pitches? Or do I have my guy confused?
Yeah, two starts ago, he had the complete game shutout where he threw 135 pitches. And last week, I thought he pitched pretty well. He still gave up. I think he gave up 5 runs last week. But if LSU turns a double play, Cade Anderson has a much better night statistically last week. And then last night, he strikes out 10. He doesn't walk anyone. But yet he gives up 4 home runs. And that just tells you that for the most part, he's dialed in. But there are times where he's just leaving the ball over the heart of the plate and guys are whacking it out of the park.
So how do you fix that?
Well, Jay Johnson at the end of the game didn't seem too concerned. Now, granted, Jay Johnson is someone to never really – express any kind of frustration or concerns about his players. He's never one to really throw anybody under, not to say he would throw Cade Anderson under the bus last night, but he's hardly ever critical about a player with the media after the game. And he did bring up a good point. The ball was traveling last night. I mean, Ethan Frye's 2-run homer last night looked like it was going to be a routine fly ball to the right fielder, and it just kept carrying it and went out of the park. So there were 7 home runs hit in that game last night. So the ball was carrying out over the fence. But Cade Anderson just got to be a little bit better with his command. He's good enough where he's not walking people, and it could be worse for him if he was walking people. At least he's just giving up, for the most part, solo home runs or 2-run home runs. He's not, walking a couple guys and then giving up the 3-run homer, because as we saw last night, how devastating a 3-run homer can be. LSU hit 2 of them last night, and Alabama was down for the count. So I think it's obviously something that Nate Yeske is going to try to work with him on, making sure that, if he's going to miss a spot, just don't leave it over the heart of the plate for these guys to get a good swing on it and hit it out of the ballpark.
Jeff, only 60 seconds left. I do want to talk about LSU football. Spring practice over with, transfer portal, and Brian Kelly's handling of it. What happens from here with LSU football?
Well, we've seen a couple guys, some of the guys on the bottom of the depth chart have entered the transfer portal. I think he's hoping that most of the main guys come back. I think that's what's going to occur, and I don't really see LSU diving in there and trying to acquire more players out of the transfer portal. He told us on Tuesday he likes his roster, and he thinks it's good enough to compete next year for a championship.
So what happens now? Just weightlifting and all that stuff until
I think they take a little bit of a break here, but really I think it gets really going again once the spring semester is over with, maybe around June 1st or something. That's when they really start dialing in onto the off-season conditioning program.
Got to hit that weight room. Thank you, Jeff.
Yep.
Appreciate your time. We'll talk to Sydney Torres as we come back about this French Quarter garbage debacle. Tommy Tucker, WWL. 7:15, beautiful Easter weekend. Good Friday is going to be nice today. A lot of people having crawfish boils. Highs of 80. 84, 85 maybe. It's a little bit warm, but not too bad overall, not compared to summertime at least. The humidity's not as bad as it is then. Could be more humid as the weekend proceeds, though. Tomorrow, highs of 83 with some clouds moving in. Pretty much same on Sunday, but dry, so get out and enjoy it. If there's one thing I learned in the four semesters it took me to get through statistics at UNO, it was type 1 and type 2 errors. Type 1 is when you reject the null hypothesis when it's actually true. So, in other words, something's broken and you don't fix it. A type 2 error is when something's broken and you do. I'm mixing it all up. Sydney Torres joins us right now, who's smarter than I'll ever. You understand what I'm saying, Sydney?
I got you, Tommy. I got you. Good morning.
Good morning. Sydney Torres is the rock star. Let's say a couple of things about Sydney Torres. I was working tonight a long time ago, and I was just talking to him about something, and he's hanging out with Lenny Kravitz. Just happened to be there. So you remember that, do you?
I do.
So who you been hanging out with lately? Rock star, New Orleans garbage rock star. Who you been hanging out with? Tell me. Give me some
names.
Drop some names, Sydney. Come on. Who you been hanging out with?
Honestly, tell you the truth, I've been working so much, but Lenny and I are still really good friends. I met him when I was 12 years old, and we've been friends for a long time.
Give me some other names in your circle.
You like Kid Rock. Kid Rock's a good one.
Yeah. Anybody else?
I don't know if I want to divulge anybody else's names. You know, you don't want to name. I don't want to name drop here. I don't want to name drop.
Well, that's what I want you to do, because I may as well, do something. Let me tell you something. It's hard for me to be impartial here because I'm a fan of yours. I think you're everything that America's about. I think you're an entrepreneur, and I think you also care about the city that you live in. I don't know anything about you personally, but I think you got enough money where you could live wherever you wanted, and you choose to stay here, and you choose to try to make it better. Is anything incorrect there with what I said?
I'm very blessed, and I feel I've worked really hard for where I am today, and I can tell you that I sold my first company, and like I said, I'm blessed, and it is true that I could live in other places, and I choose to live here because I love this city, I love the culture, I love the people, and it's just a great city. I don't like the politics in this type of situation that we're in right now, and that's the thing that just discourages me. Big time. That's why I sold my company the last time. I got tired of dealing with all the politics, and it was just, I just had enough.
And let me tell you one more thing, young man. Don't ever get caught doing anything wrong or do anything wrong, because it's going to be another hero that goes down. So don't do that, all right?
Absolutely not. It's not worth it. Look, like I said, I'm blessed. I've made my money, and I enjoy what I do. I don't need to. I work hard. I get on the trucks. I get behind the trucks. I pick up the trash. I don't need to hire people to pay people to get things. That's just not how I operate. Never operated that way, and I would never operate that way.
All right, let's talk about what's going on in French Quarter with this garbage contract. Let's talk about the nuts and bolts of it first off, and give me the story. Leave the politics out of it, but just give me the business part of it. We'll talk about the politics when we come back.
As far as what, the French Quarter?
Yeah.
What would you like to know about it?
Well, here's
because it's all littered with politics. So I mean, we can
littered. You'd be in the operative word. So here's what I'm saying. I guess I want to start with the contractual part of it, because, and then we'll go from what's going to happen. This to me, just as a layman, seems like here's a deal where the government finds somebody that's doing the job beyond what could be expected, and everything's great. So why in the world would you screw it up? And that's exactly kind of what's going on here?
Oliver Thomas is pushing Troy Henry. I mean, that's the bottom line. He's running for mayor. He's pushing his cousin. He said it. He said he's his cousin. He's pushing him to get this deal. And, if it's there's no reason to change this. We have a one-year deal to December 23rd. There's no reason to change this. This is absolutely insane. The council has said it. They didn't vote on it. When the original bid went in, Troy Henry changed his price $500,000-$600,000 more after the grading was done. It was done. The grading was done, and they awarded it to him. But he changed the price in $400,000-$600,000, and then came back. The council's like, we don't like this. You can't do that. That's not how it works. And there were some other things too. With he was getting rid of the subcontractor he had that they didn't like, because they were hiring a subcontractor to pick up the garbage from Monroe. So he was basically he's basically going to be the middleman. He's hiring all these people, and I heard that he's still going to do that. He's looking to hire people who live that don't even live here, that live, one's from Monroe, one's from St. Tammany, And so, you know, he's just the middleman subbing all this out. And, you know, the thing is that it really isn't even about him. It's just the way they went about it by sending a letter to me and canceling it for 5 months before the actual contract ends. I just think it's just not the right thing to do. Like you said, when you opened up this interview, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
Is it legal what they did?
Yeah, I mean, look, when I bid on this, I knew that the 90-day cancellation could be put into effect, but never thought in a million years that it would be put into effect because of the fact that we're doing a great job. And, you know, we have $1.5 million worth of equipment that I bought and put in there and made it to where it looks like today. You can't do that unless you can't clean the French Quarter unless you have the right tools to clean the French Quarter.
Let me talk about that when we come back. I want to talk about the specific process of cleaning the quarter, what it looks like now after you finish, and what it was looking like before you got involved. 7:21 more with Sidney Torres when we come back. I've seen LaToya Cantrell and a lot of politics in New Orleans, but this is just egregious beyond egregious, and the French Quarter is, of course, a cash register. Traffic now, WWL. 7:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Sidney Torres, who owns, tell me the name of the company, IV Waste? I don't know how to pronounce it. I always want to say three. Yeah, I always want to say three. But anyway, and he's had the contract canceled when the city decided to go with Metro to clean the quarter. And as far as I understand it, everybody that is in the quarter is very happy with the job you're doing. Tell me about how it is that you go about cleaning the quarter and what it looks like after it's finished.
Well, first off, you have to have the right people and the right tools, and you have to have the experience. And we have plenty of experience because after Katrina, you know, we created the Disney-like cleanliness of the French Quarter. And when I sold my company, it went downhill. And the problem is that when you look at where we are today, the company that had it before me was not Metro. Metro was the company that had the other part of the city that I have now. We pick up 95% of the residential waste and the garbage in the city of New Orleans and the recycling. The French Quarter is a very small piece of it, but it's a very important piece because it's the cash register for the city and the state. I mean, the amount of revenue that it generates tax dollar wise for the city and the state is unbelievable. And so right now it's not over. I mean, you know, I know this, I got the letter and they said that it's going to be canceled, but I can't share too much, but I know that there's things going on where this is not over. So we'll see what happens. But at the end of the day, we're going to continue to give the great service that we've been giving, and we're going to continue to give it our all and to whatever happens at the end.
I know Billy Nungesser's a big fan, Lieutenant Governor of yours, as am I, and a job you do in the French Quarter. Is he involved in this, Sidney?
You know, he's involved, but this is a city thing here. And again, I think the state is looking at this closely. I think everybody's looking at it closely. I mean, look, I've been seeing emails just people sending me or blind copying me or, you know, friends that know friends that have sent emails in to council and to the mayor. And the biggest thing is people say, look, I'm thinking about selling my business. I'm thinking about selling my home. You know, you can't live in a place full of litter and trash and stink. And the problem is like the company that had it before me, they would walk through with a pressure washer, and all they were doing is just going down the sidewalk, just basically walking with a Home Depot style pressure washer. And you can't do that. Like, you know, you've got to build the right tools. Like the pressure washer machines we run are around $100,000 a piece.
I was going to ask you that, Sidney. How, capital expenditure wise, how far are you into this with the stuff you bought to clean a quarter?
Well, if you back out the trucks that we already owned, it's around $1.5 million. If you add the trucks that we own with it, it's about 2.5.
And you are the only guy that has this equipment, correct?
We're the only ones that custom built it. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Because he doesn't have it. I mean, what he's going to do is sub everything out. He's going to be the consultant because that's what he does. His name, you know, he's a consultant. He's going to be the consultant, the middleman, and he's going to sub all this out. And there's a big difference. You don't own it when you don't have it. You know, subbing things out is just not the way to do it. You've got to own it. You've got to be involved. You have to have the right equipment. I mean, I'm out there every day. I'm riding, watching, making sure. Plus, I have great supervisors. I mean, you know, I have supervisors that did this after Katrina. They know what the level of service we expect, and they're out there picking up trash and cleaning the ground as well. So it's important.
You started this by telling me why you think this happened, and I'm going to ask you to repeat it. Why do you think this happened?
I think it happened because Troy Henry, who's running for mayor, Oliver Thomas, who's running for mayor, Troy Henry said that's his cousin. He said it on TV that that's his cousin. And I think Oliver's pushing it. Troy's pushing it because he wants it. And I think that's what's going on here. And I think because there's no reason to switch this over right now. And Oliver's running for mayor. The last thing he should be doing is meddling this. I mean, he did the Jazz Land, Six Flags. He did the airport, the DDD. It's just, you know, to me, let's redo the specs, whether you go with IV or not. Redo the specs to match the level of equipment, the level of service, and put it out to bid so you get the right person that with the right equipment. I'm not saying that I'm the only one that can do it, but right now people need to learn from what we're doing, look at our equipment, look at the level of service we're giving, and they need to write the specs to match that. Right now the current specs do not match what we're doing, and I don't care if Troy Henry says we're going to do it. You can say what you want to say, but to do it, you have to invest the money, you have to have the right people, and you can't sub it out. It just doesn't work. I've seen it. We've seen it. That's why people were complaining before. You've got to own it. You've got to be down on the ground, and you've got to own it.
Somebody texted in, why would I say 3 when IV is 4 in Roman numerals? Because I'm math impaired. That's why. Thank you. Thank you for ignoring that, Sydney, and thank you. Good luck, man. Stay in touch, all right?
Thank you, Tom.
Have a nice Easter. All right, Sydney Torres, we'll take a break. Come back. Help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, time to help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. If you can safely, go to jeffersonfinancial.org. You'll find some calculators there, almost 100 of them, that'll help you with all kinds of different things. With that, we welcome in Mark Rosa. How you doing, Mark?
Happy Friday, sir. I'm doing well.
Happy Friday to you as well. What are we talking about today?
Tommy, you know, that we get news updates all during the day, market news updates, and it's they feel like they never complete without saying, given a quote on where the Dow is or the S&P 500 is. And that's been so routine for so long, and people want to know where the markets are moving. And they know kind of intuitively that, well, that might impact my own holdings or my own stock investments. And if somebody says the Dow is up today, well, that generally puts a smile on people's faces. They believe that their 401 can be up. We also know, however, that if the Dow is up, our personal investments could be down because the Dow only represents 30 large companies. So it kind of segued over to what's a better barometer of market action, and it would be the S&P 500 because within the name, it represents the movement, the average movement of 500 companies. So if the S&P is up, well, it's a better than average chance that your holdings will be up and your 401k will be up. And I guess that's what gives us some idea of where the markets are moving and where our own investments are moving. What's seldom mentioned is if you have anything on the borrowing side, is there any type of barometer that keeps an eye on rates, where they're going? Because rates, of course, are moving with market conditions, not just when the Fed chooses to move some rates. And actually, the Fed, when they do move rates very specifically, it really only impacts with precision the early end of the market. What I mean by that is that they're physically changing short-term rates, and then the market decides where the other rates are being changed or if they move at all, going out to long-term rates. So I wanted to bring that up this morning because I had a couple of people that members of the credit union that came in, they wanted to make a mortgage loan. You know, that's not fast like a car loan in and out. It's, you know, you gather all the paperwork, you do appraisals on the property and all the things that naturally go into loans on houses or real estate. And it's like they got caught in between some movement in rates. And it's like, why did the rates move? Well, we would price off of, like many financial institutions, you price off of Fannie Mae. You can contact them every day from a lender's perspective. And it's like, where have rates moved? And keep in mind that the Fed's not done anything since last year, and rates have moved. So what is the barometer? It's what it is the U.S. Treasury 10-year note rate. And what sounds like a mouthful is really not. It's the rate that the federal government borrows money for a 10-year term. And I tried it this morning. I'm a subscriber to the Wall Street Journal, so I see their graphs and I see a lot of the material that they provide me. I pay for that. But for somebody, you don't have to pay for that. If you Googled it on your phone, I was Googling on my computer, 10-year Treasury note rate, plenty of information comes up absolutely free, 24/7, and you can't get away from it. It's right there for anybody that wants to see it. So the beginning of the year, the 10-year rate started at about 4.6%, and it had a steady decline all the way to the end of March. Now, that's been good news. You and I were talking just a couple of weeks ago about there were 6 weeks in a row where mortgage rates were falling. The 10-year note rate has a lot to do with where mortgage rates are and where they're going. So from that barometer standpoint, if you want to know what the stock market is doing, you're never far away from an S&P 500 quote. Well, it's the same thing with people that are interested in buying or selling a house or refinancing or doing all those things with long-term debt, i.e. mortgages. So why is a 10-year note rate from the government, why is that having an impact on 30-year money that people, just citizens, you and I would borrow? Well, the Mortgage Lenders Association did a lot of research, and they continue to do it. This is a continuing process, that the average mortgage only stays out there for about 12 years. People are moving, they're buying, they're selling, they're refinancing, they're doing something to the mortgage that they hold, and that is the average life of a mortgage. Seldom does somebody make a loan today and hold it the full 30 years and just be squeezing that 360th payment when it goes out to finally pay the house off. So with those modifications, meaning a refinance or something, well, it starts over. That's a new mortgage. The old mortgage is paid off. And again, the average is 12 years. The Treasury doesn't have 12-year money. They borrow money in increments that when you get out to the longer end of what's called the curve, it's 10-year, 20-year, 30-year. So the 10-year Treasury rate is the one that all of Wall Street, financial markets, mortgage markets, they look to where that 10-year is, and mortgage rates tend to move in the similar direction as the 10-year Treasury rate. So right now it's 4.33 as of this morning. If the federal government went to borrow money, they're always borrowing money. That's why we have the deficit that we have. So if they went out to borrow money this morning, at least in theory, they're going to pay 4.33%. Does that mean that we're going to get a 4.3% mortgage? Of course not. There's what's called the spread. The Treasury doesn't have to worry about defaults. They have a printing press. They could always pay their bills. People, not so much. You've got some default in there because something will happen to somebody where their mortgage is going to be interrupted due to default. So what it normally is, Tom, is a point and a half above that is where the 30-year mortgage should be. Where is it now? Well, it's about 2 points above because of all the news of the tariffs. And that has injected some uncertainty into financial markets. And as far as people going out to borrow money, a couple of people came in. And again, where the year started, it was about 4.6. And the 10-year rate fell just a few weeks ago. It was 4.0. So that's where I remember you and I talking in the spring, in around March, that 30, I looked it up on bankrate.com, that you had some 30-year mortgages that started with the number 5. So if the government was paying 4% for money, a 2% spread would mean we're paying 6%, and then they backed that down. A couple of lenders wanted to have the first mover's advantage because it looked like the economy was improving, meaning inflation was ebbing, and it has been. And the Fed was getting closer to a point in the summer where they're expected to lower rates. So, okay, we got some advance notice. The market started to move with that, brought the rate down to 6%. Some people were loaning in the 5s, and then the tariffs came on April 2nd. So what happened to many borrowers, they were coming in and getting their mortgages done, but right before they were locking in the rates, called Fannie Mae, and it was up by a half a point. That's not all the money in the world, but people notice. It was enough to change their monthly payment because it's big money for a long time, and it was like, what gives? We were just in here a week ago, and we were talking about rates. Absolutely. And the 10-year rate flipped up a half a point. It took no time at all, and that repriced all of the mortgage market. So I guess what I'm saying is there is a barometer. There is something that we could look, we, everybody, all our listeners could look at. If you get used to that, you get used to like the S&P 500 and you understand, well, that might be affecting my 401k, largely full of equities. What happens to the stuff when we're trying to borrow money and we want to get, obviously, the financing as cheaply as possible? It would be that 10-year Treasury note, and it's popped up. It pulled back just a little bit, so I think people were getting an idea that the tariffs weren't going to be around too long, but I was listening to you talk about what Buddy Nungesser was saying. It's creating some short-term risk and uncertainty. And for many reasons, I hope that pulls away quickly, because then the 10-year note rate will resume its decline and mortgage rates will follow right in suit.
Very valuable information. Thank you, Mark.
Pleasure,
Roser,
sir.
President and CEO, Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, 7:54 and a half. Time for traffic now, WWL. 8:12 now, joined by a good friend, Walt Leger, President and CEO of New Orleans & Company. How you doing, Walt?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm great. How are you?
I am awesome, as always, and it's good to talk to you. How big of a weekend for tourism is Easter in New Orleans? We'll start there, since it is Easter weekend.
Not a very big one.
No.
Easter weekend is in New Orleans is a lot about family, about people coming together around the region, but typically not a heavy visitation weekend. For us, from a tourism standpoint, it's just more about crawfish boils and cookouts and good family stuff. So we've got people coming in to stay with family a lot. We've got people coming in for friends and family type visits, but not a whole lot of tourism activity on Easter weekend.
So I don't know if you were on with Newell the other day or not, but I wanted to talk to you about it as well, because we all have different questions about the report that's out with the New Orleans & Company 2024 annual report. But before we get into that, you know, as I was getting ready to talk to you this morning, I'm thinking we had a big year with the Super Bowl and the Taylor Swift concert before that. That wasn't in this calendar year, of course. But really, tourism, it's not the big events like that or the, I hate to say one-offs, but it's the basic tourism and conventions, and those are the things that are really the bread and butter of tourism, or not?
Yeah, no, I think you're right on. The big events get so much of the attention, and they rightfully so. They draw a lot of attention. They create a lot of opportunity for us to talk about how special our community is on a big stage. But it really is sort of the day-to-day grind that keeps things moving, and a lot of that has to do with the sales team that's selling conventions, conferences, and meetings. And then the tourism team that's working on bringing in group leisure travel and family reunions and military reunions and weddings and things like that. You know, it's often not even the big 7,000, 10,000, 15,000 person convention. It's these 100 people meetings, these 200 person meetings, the weddings. And like I said, those events kind of keep things steady. But you've really got to work and compete for those, because there's a lot of competition out there, and also you need those day in and day out so that things can stay stabilized for the community and for the people who work in the industry.
It's not like you got to make it up in volume.
Definitely a volume business. You know, I think that you count on these big events to give you a bump or to give you a little bit of extra. Those things definitely can make. They can take a year from being a good year to a great year, but if you're not doing the basics day in and day out and competing every day, then those big bumps aren't gonna show up when you want them to, and furthermore, they're not gonna be sustainable in any way for the community at large. So, I mean, that's part of why I love the team we work with. I mean, they're grinders. They show up, they work, they're trying to bring business here every day. It's not really the most glorious thing. Certainly feels that way when you've got a Super Bowl or some other big event that people are paying attention to, but it's a lot of, in the trenches working every day, trying to bring opportunity to the community and competing and winning, and that's what makes me, I think, the most proud of the team.
Well, I'm going to tell you what, I've been around a while, and just having been with you guys from Mardi Gras and the Super Bowl and everything else, and I think it starts at the top with you. One thing I think that you've done, and I don't know if the report addresses this or not, But you have developed a team at New Orleans and Company that, I mean, emphasizes and epitomizes the word team. You really do work very cohesively with each other to achieve the common goal.
Well, that means the world to me to hear you say it, Tommy. It's important to us. We, I think we all recognize that all the things that we do in the various departments rely on each other and also bring value to each other, and really trying to hone in on that. When you think about the public relations team and the 2,500 or so stories placed last year that are positive about the city, you need that to be able to increase our reputation and put us in a position for sales team to be able to succeed. Obviously, the social media and marketing team is out there promoting the messages about how remarkable our city is, and the culinary and music and all the other great creative individuals who live in the community that make us this special place. Everybody's got to be on the same page doing the right things, or, you know, with one of those things slips, it makes it harder for everyone else. And I think people have really bought into that. And at the end of the day, what it takes is being persistent and not giving up and showing up no matter what. 25's not been without its challenges and uncertainty. It's also had some really high highs. And so trying to stay level and keep working, keep your head down, keep doing what you've got to do to produce. I'm really proud of the team for that, and the results are speaking to that. You know, I think we're on the right track. We've got to keep going.
I've been around organizations, and I mean it sincerely. Sometimes, and you know what, I'm no Walt Leger, but I do have a good funk detector. I can smell BS or who's faking it, and that's not the case with your organization, man. I mean, it's really committed as a team. Tell me what some of the highlights of the 2024 report were, Walt.
Well, there's so many. I mean, you know, the convention sales and services team closed about 1.5 million group hotel room nights. That's for meetings and conferences. And that's a big deal. You know, we talk a lot about punching above our weight, and that's another area in which we do it. Really proud to see recognition that in the top 250 meetings anywhere in the country that rotate around, we finished in the top three for the second year in a row. And what that means to me is that it's good to finish in the top three in one year, but if you finish 15th or 20th in the next year, that's not so good. And for us to finish in the top three a couple of years in a row with rotating meetings means we're competing for all of these big meetings, and that's something that's the consistency that you're looking for. I love the 2,500 or a little more than 2,500 positive stories placed in media all over the country. I think my favorite was when Travel and Leisure declared us to be one of the top destinations in the world to visit in August. Mm-hmm. I told Kelly Schultz on our PR team, that's like convincing somebody that Buffalo is a great place to watch mm-hmm. a football game in January.
Right, exactly.
So those are a couple of things. I mean, there's so many on here.
Let me take a break, Walt. We'll pick it up when we come back. I want to look ahead to 2025. I also want to talk about the lieutenant governor and what he told Newell Norman about tariffs and international tourism and your concerns about that looking ahead to 2025. 8:20 now, time for traffic, WWL. 8:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back to Walt Leger, proud to call him my friend, president and CEO of New Orleans & Company, as I am his dad, Walter Leger. Walt, story from Bloomberg via Yahoo Finance, U.S. economy set to lose billions of dollars in revenue in 2025 from a pullback in foreign tourism, boycotts of American products, arrivals of non-citizens to the U.S. by plane dropped by almost 10% in March from a year earlier. I got to believe, and I'm not trying to get politics into this at all, this is business, it's not personal, that this is on your radar.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had the benefit of being in D.C. a week and a half ago for a few days. I serve on the board of U.S. Travel Association. And of course, we're meeting with our congressional leaders and with other leaders in the administration, talking about opportunities that exist that we can take advantage of for our country over the next couple years, and also kind of battling some of this uncertainty. And, you know, we've got FIFA World Cup coming to the United States in 2026. We've got the Olympics in 2028. There is a projection of 50 million or so visitors that could be joining us for those events. And
a huge impact, multi-billion-dollar impact to the economy if we can make that happen. And, you know, what we've been advocating for years is upgrades in technology, making it easier and more seamless for people to visit. And so seeing some of these uncertainties emerge because of tariffs and, you know, other decisions is certainly concerning. We have not stopped communicating, you know, via our foreign offices. We've got offices in Canada, the UK, Australia, Germany, Mexico, of course, and a few others that are out there selling New Orleans and selling Louisiana. And we haven't stopped. We're continuing to see some we're continuing to see a lot of interest in New Orleans, and we're expecting the visitation to continue. But we're certainly seeing a lot of sentiment that suggests that we're in for a rough ride. And when you're talking about a trillion-dollar travel industry, a few percentage points here and there are major impacts to the economy, and we are we certainly are concerned about that.
And the number one and two countries for tourism coming to New Orleans are Canada and Mexico. The countries are kind of in the crosshairs. I don't know. I know you book convention business decades out. Is the business from Canada and Mexico, and Germany is third, UK is fourth, are they convention? Is that any convention business, or does this affect convention business or individual tourism more?
Yeah, no, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I mean, the reality is that when you have major conventions like ours, they often have an international component to it that's not insignificant. And so just last week, you saw some reports that we had a major hurricane prognostication organization come to town. They were about 10% off on attendance, largely because of government employees that were not traveling at this point. So we're seeing an impact from a loss of government and academic travel on just about any convention or conference we're having. And we're also hearing and getting some challenges from some of our corporate customers that have smaller meetings in New Orleans scheduled into the future. So we're working through those things with them. But I think the answer is both. Right. I mean, international travel is largely on the leisure side, but that business is really important to us. They stay longer and they spend more. Last year, we rebounded to nearly 500,000 international visitors who spent in excess of $700 million. And we're just approaching back to COVID levels, and with many years of growth projected into the future. On the convention side, though, it's a smaller impact, but not an insignificant one. And so we want to get back to being the most welcoming place in the world. We have led international travel as a country for many, many years. That slipped a little bit last year, and we want to get that back. So we're focused on continuing to make sure people know that New Orleans is an incredibly welcoming place for everyone, and we want them here to experience how remarkable our city is.
They're going to get mad at me, but we're going to be a minute late here, because some of the best advice I ever got in radio was from an old timer who said, don't ever lose your audience, because once you lose them, it's hard to get them back. Is it the same in the tourism business?
Well, you certainly don't want to risk it. And we're making sure that we're communicating with the people that we've always worked with, so that there's no doubt about how much we want to do business with them. Particularly true of Canada, our number one international guest, and that share such a unique cultural heritage with the people of Louisiana, South Louisiana, and New Orleans. And we're not going to stop working to make sure that they know they're welcome here in every way. And I think we feel the same way about the world and the country. We're not backing off on any segment. We're going to keep telling our story, keep doing our work, keep our heads down, and keep bringing people here to create opportunities for our people.
Thank you, Walt. Tell everybody happy Easter for me. Walt Leger, President and CEO of New Orleans & Company, with apologies a minute late now to Dave Cohen and WWL First News. 8:47, 13 till 9, Easter weekend coming up. We thought we'd check in with our good friend Kevin Belton, chef over at WWL Louisiana, get some hints, some cooking tips. How you doing, Chef Kev?
I'm doing fine, Tommy. How's everything?
Well, very good, sir. I heard your story with Courtney P, and you said go to casseroles, and I would take it a step further to enjoy your Easter and say go to Piccadilly's. Just kidding.
Hey, there you go.
Let me.
You know, I was talking with some friends yesterday. I don't mean to. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm here every day, Kevin. I want to hear what you have to say.
I was talking with some friends yesterday because they were saying, man, they weren't sure what they're going to do for the kids because the chocolate is so expensive and all. Mm-hmm. The best thing I ever did with my boys, and now my son does it with his kids, you know, the plastic eggs that you can buy at the drugstores and stuff. Mm-hmm. I used to take plastic eggs. Some of them I'd put like a roll up a dollar and put in them. The others I would make coupons. Like, good to stay up 30 minutes late on a school night. Good for your favorite meal. Good for dinner and a movie. You know, so we're at home, you make popcorn and you know, you watch your favorite movie. And it's a great way because the kids aren't loaded up on chocolate and candy.
And also I heard Peyton Malone talking about chocolate and the eggs, how it's going to be hot and it's going to melt. So even all the more reason to do that. That's a great idea, Chef Kev. You know what I want to talk to you about?
What's that?
Ham. Because a lot of people cook ham and lamb for Easter, and I want to talk to you about ham. And is there a first of all? Have you ever cooked a raw ham, or do they always come cooked? And if you do cook a raw ham, what's the difference between that and something that's already cooked? Because if it's already cooked, you're just heating it, basically, right?
Yeah, basically, most of the hams you're going to see are already cured and already cooked. So basically, like all the spiral hams and things like that, mm-hmm. you basically have to heat them up all the way through. That's what you're doing. You know, a raw ham
but
is
to
almost
serve
like
it
cooking.
Or for safety, when you get a spiral sliced ham, you can just start picking off of it and eat it if you want, or do you have to heat it up?
No, you could just pick it off and eat it like you want.
I got you.
You know, just like you do deli meat.
Got you.
You know?
Okay.
But the whole thing about usually the spiral hams, and then when folks do cook a ham, it's all about that the glaze they put on once that ham is heated all the way through. Where mom used to take Coke and add a little sugar to it. Sometimes she'd put raw sugar to it and heat that up, and maybe put in a little brown sugar, throw in some mustard, and she'd use that as a glaze on the ham after it got cooked.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Now, if you do buy a raw ham, and I have seen these, I don't even know how you go about it. You're talking about curing a ham. If you don't cure it, it would seem to me if you cook a ham, it's going to come out like some kind of pork roast or something. Am I wrong?
Pretty much. I mean, you just got to make sure it's cooked all the way through. You know, one of the best expenses in the kitchen is that $3.25 thermometer to make sure you reach an internal temperature of at least 160 degrees, just to make sure that it's cooked all the way through. But I would suggest if it's something that you're not, you know, when you're doing something for the first time, don't do it on a holiday when you have folks coming over. Mm-hmm. Do it on a day when, you know, you have time. Okay, let me try this weekend, you know. But never, you know, when friends and family are coming over, especially for holidays, don't try something new. Stick with something that's tried and true, you know.
Have you ever cooked a raw ham yourself?
No, okay. I haven't.
I always wondered about that, like what it would taste like, because I don't think it would taste any different than pork roast or anything else. Let me take a break. We'll talk about...
You know what's crazy?
Huh. No, go ahead. Tell me what.
I'm sorry. I'm not a big meat eater, like hams and roast and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I cook them for a family, but I don't eat them.
I'm right there with
That's
you, Chef
me.
Kev. It's crazy. Yeah. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back. I'm going to talk about cooking lamb, because I got some text about that. They want to cook lamb because I think it's a traditional Greek dish, or some other people want to try it, and I don't know anything about it, but we'll talk about it with Chef Kevin Belton. We come back. If you got any questions about cooking or anything, barbecuing, grilling, boiling crawfish, you name it, a good Friday, a big crawfish boiling day. Text it in the Oconor Jeweler Talking text line, 504-260-1870. Text, message, and data rates apply. Please do not ever text and drive. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 8:57 now, a couple of minutes left with Chef Kevin Belton, our good friend from WWL Louisiana, and just one nice man, just a lovely man. Anyway, somebody texted in, Kevin said, please get Chef to share his best recipe for boiling crawfish or shrimp.
The whole trick is cooling them down and let them soak. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've had friends and I don't like to dump ice in, but I will take frozen corn, and dump the frozen corn in, you know, because you just want them to barely get cooked. And then where they absorb the flavors in that soak.
You talking about shrimp now, crawfish, or both?
Talking about both.
Okay.
You know, it's you know, crawfish need a little longer than shrimp, but shrimp are so delicate and tender that it's all about that flavor. So go ahead, over-season, just barely get them boiled, and then dump in, like, frozen corn, because the corn will drop that temperature as they soak to absorb that flavor. It'll drop the temperature a little bit so it doesn't keep cooking as much. And plus, that water's so hot, it'll get your corn cooked.
When it comes to crabs, what is the difference or distinction when it comes to boiling crabs as opposed to shrimp and crawfish?
Well, the thing about shrimp and crabs is you don't have to worry about them really getting overcooked. I mean, you do, but crabs will just get mushy. In other words, the shell on the shrimp, when it gets overcooked, sticks to it like glue.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you want to try to cool them down to where they're not overcooking, because that shell is just going to turn into like clear wrap on that shrimp.
Do you let crabs soak?
Yeah. You let the crab soak just like you do crawfish or shrimp. But the crabs can soak longer because that shell is so thick. There's such a thick shell.
What's your favorite thing to put in, somebody wants to know, extras in the crawfish boil? Because today is a big day for boiling crawfish.
Sausage, corn, potatoes, mushrooms, artichokes.
Pineapples?
Some artichokes and throw those in. I haven't done that, but yeah, that'll work.
I don't know.
I've thrown in oranges into a boil.
Really? Does it change?
Citrusy flavor, yeah.
The nature of it? Good?
It gives it a little different flavor. All lemons right. And oranges, yeah, that citrus helps.
Chef Kevin, thank you so much. That's a great tip about the eggs. Put a little coupon in there for stay up late one night.
Yeah.
And what's some of the other ideas? Stay up late or...
up late, your favorite dinner one night, your, you know, move dinner, popcorn in a movie at home.
You get to pick the movie, know? Those kind of things. That's awesome. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chef Kev. Love you, brother.
Same to you.
Kevin
Belton. Right, have a good Easter, man.
You too, sir. Chef at WWL Louisiana. Speaking of food, we come back. We'll do as we do every Friday, talk to Ian McNulty about eating and drinking around the New Orleans area. Then we'll talk with the Four Kids Foundation. You know, it's funny you should say that, because I'm just thinking today is one of those days that it's kind of like a holiday, but if you have a job where nobody's watching, or
you may go to lunch and not come back.
You show up, you move a couple of things around, you talk about Easter plans, this, that, the other thing. For us, it's kind of hard to shuffle papers on a desk, right? I mean, you got to work.
Yeah, we've kind of got to do the same
thing
every
day. But we do loosen up a little bit, and we were talking about the Bill. Before that, who was the buddy? Who's the coach from the
Leach?
Leach, yeah. Have any
Mike
idea
Leach.
To put a little person in the backfield and throw him over the goal line for a touchdown, kind of like a tush-push, and they had to say, no, that's not a good idea. And then we got to Bill Veeck, and Eddie Goodell was the man's name, the small person, little person that he put in to bat. He was 3 feet, 7 inches tall. He wore the number 1/8.
What was the size of his strike zone? That don't be just a few inches.
It wasn't much, I'll tell you that. And Tim tells me he was the only player that got on base, that one of five players that got on base but never did anything else, right? Never took the field.
So
I guess he
was
replaced
hitter.
By a runner. Yeah, I guess, or replaced by a runner. I don't know, but that's odd. But it's interesting he wore the number 1/8. Getting back to the crawfish thing.
That can't be legal in the rules, but okay.
I don't think any of this is, you know. According to Hoyle.
So you frowned at the idea of putting a pineapple on the crawfish
board. And I'll tell people we're getting ready to talk to Ian McNulty, as we do every Friday, eating and drinking. And Tim, you can bring him up right now if he wants to join in this conversation.
We'll make him pick sides is what we're going to do
now. No, but we're talking that, and I'll even bring the audience into it at 504-260-1870, the Okunor Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Text, data, and message rates may apply. Please don't ever text and drive. What's the oddest thing you've ever found in a crawfish boil? Because, Ian McNulty, you judge a lot of crawfish boils. I've been involved in a fair amount of them. Dave, I don't know about you, but I know sometimes people...
No, I just eat it. I don't judge
people
it.
Try to do things to stand out, and I'm not a big fan of the pineapple. Dave, you say you like it.
Oh, God. To take a fresh pineapple, shave off the prickly skin, and drop the whole thing in there and then take it out and cut it up. Oh, I akin it to the mushrooms, not in flavor, but in the way it explodes with taste in your mouth, that every bite of that pineapple is sweet and spicy.
But does it not affect the crawfish, or you do that after you boil the crawfish?
I don't note any actual difference in the tail meat. And I would challenge anybody, do you really taste the difference if people put oranges in the boil? Do you taste the difference in the actual tail meat itself?
Well, Kevin Belton said it did add a citrus flavor to it.
Now, well, I think Ian, to everything else. I don't know about to the tail meat.
Ian McNulty, what else would it add the flavor to?
Well, the corn and the potatoes and the mushrooms.
Ian McNulty, you've judged a lot of contests as well, and you know as well as I that sometimes people try to do stuff. Like one time I had one where people put cinnamon in the boil to try to make it different and stand out. It stood out all right because it was horrible. What about you, Ian McNulty?
Hey, let me tell you this. Yes, we've officially judged some crawfish boils, but all of us out there who take crawfish seriously judge every boil. Every one of us
yes.
is a judge. We show up,
that's
right?
Of our own boils.
That's
yes.
true. That's true. Everybody. Yeah. If you're boiling, you're getting judged. If you're eating, you're yes. judging.
Oh, and there's no worse feeling than disappointing the family at a boil, but there's no better feeling than everyone just loving it.
Well, you know what? That's an interesting point, Dave, because the first time I did it, I think I did disappoint the family. And for people like a Good Friday or something like that, Ian McNulty, jump in where you feel comfortable. That's not the time to do your first boil, because it's not like frying food where you get instant feedback. It's kind of like an acquired skill. Guys, thoughts?
Well, let me tell you this, guys. I think, and I have a column up right now on NOLA.com kind of doing a deeper dive on this, but this weekend, Easter weekend, maybe even Good Friday in particular, launches the high holy days of crawfish across South Louisiana. And yeah, cheers to all who celebrate, by the way. Because yeah,
amen.
After the paper shuffling is done midday today, you know, it's direct to the boiling pot.
Midday? I've been shuffling them since 6. Dave started at 5, but go ahead, please.
Sure. And the big thing that I take away from it is, you have your family there, you have your friends there, and you have this process and this technique, and I dare say, you know, somewhere between the technique of serious barbecue and ritual worthy of the Old Testament is going into these annual get-togethers, you know, the Easter boil, the Mother's Day boil, the Father's Day boil. But then think about all these other days of observation, let's call them, that we have in the springtime here in Louisiana, like the graduations, springtime weddings, the festivals with the, you know, people who have their parties every year on the second Saturday of Jazz Fest or whatever it is.
The cold fronts.
Yeah, these are highly ritualized things in our culture and in our lives, and I dare say in our society in South Louisiana, and they're not to be taken lightly. You know, it's more than about that morsel of meat. It's more than about the meal. It is the way that crawfish, in particular, the boil. It could be a crab boil or shrimp boil too. Big fan of that shrimp boil. It has the framework of togetherness built in. And that's something I want you to pay attention to when you go to a boil this weekend or in the weekends coming up. It's the pace of it, right? There's a mandate built in because you can only cook crawfish so fast. The batch has to soak. There's the anticipation. Then, you know, it all gets spread across the newsprint and everybody gathers along, and you can only eat so fast. It's only the pace of fingers peeling shells and popping tail meat into your mouth. And then it starts all over again. And in that is this mandate to kind of slow down and be together. And that's increasingly rare in our world and our times. I mean, crawfish are this thing that tells us what the season is, that reinforces our sort of sense of tribal togetherness as family and friends and people who live in the area that produces crawfish and the culture around them. And I'm here to tell you, you know, in other times, other cultures, they would build temples and statues to symbols that powerful. Here, we just get another round, crack them open, and dig in. I mean, this is just the glorious time of Louisiana life.
You know, Tommy, he's sharing wise words with us here, but he has not said if he likes pineapple in his boil or not.
Well, but wait, Dave, I want to wait. Hang on a second, Dave. I don't know. Do you have a second, or do you have to get back?
No, I'm fine. I'm good. Go ahead.
Because that's a big thing with your family. You really do look at that in your family. That's a cultural thing, isn't it, the crawfish boils that you have with your family.
Oh yes, and now that my kids are grown and out of the house, and they're doing their own crawfish boils, it is fascinating to see how they have retained some of the way that I boil crawfish, but they bring new things to it. And there's always that debate and discussion. Every crawfish boil involves a, hey, should we have done this? Should it have soaked longer? Should we have heated it up faster? Should we have done that? Should this be in the pot? Should that be in the pot? It really is not only the wonderful experience of actually eating, but it's the intellectual conversation, Ian, of how to best achieve the best results.
Dave, it's designated roles, right? You know, somebody's always the quartermaster wrangling all the gear. Somebody has to be there to say you're doing it wrong and no, this is the way we do it.
We all know that guy, yes.
Yeah, so somebody has to be the person who takes the live crawfish and sets them free to terrorize the children as it scampers across the car park. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all designated roles. I mean,
across the what? The car park? Where have you been? Europe?
I hear that. Some people carport, some people car park. I've heard that.
I thought this sounded like it's in England or something, the car park.
All right, let's get back to pineapple.
Yes,
I am on Team Pineapple. I think you can put really weird stuff in your boil, and it increases the fun. There is a line. There's a line to be drawn. I've been to boils, and these were open to the public. A certain Jason Sither has done boils, not just at Sither Seafood, but at the Maple Leaf, where the Maple Leaf Bar and the Epic Music Club on Oak Street, where Hank Staples, the man who runs that, loves weird stuff in his boil. And he'll put, there's been raccoon meat in there. There's been reptiles, frog legs.
On purpose or not?
On purpose, yeah. It was like a rat in the pot somehow. And there is a line that can be crossed, and they have crossed it, because things like that can make the crawfish in general too greasy, right?
Or hairy if it's not on purpose.
Well, yeah, maybe cleaning it. But in general, the crawfish themselves are pretty durable. The spice blend is all powerful. And so all these other things are just little like flavor notes that are coming in. They're not going to overwhelm. This is not going to be a pineapple punch in your crawfish tail because of the pineapples floating around in there, but they are going to be nice little exclamation points of flavor in between the progression of crawfish. And I love it. You know, people put ravioli in there. They'll put tortellini. They'll put ramen. Sometimes it's about giving that variation. Sometimes it's just about the wow factor. But sometimes it's for outright flavor. I mean, something as simple as last week I was at a graduation crawfish boil. Congratulations to the latest PhD. We call her Dr. Street Cat. Wow, she graduated from Tulane last week. Or had her dissertation completed. Graduating soon, so maybe there'll be another boil. I digress. The key move of this boil, sweet potato. Simple as that.
Oh, you know, Tommy was talking with Ag Commissioner Mike Strain a few weeks back, and he suggested sweet potatoes. We tried it at our last boil, and I thought I was going to hate it. Loved it.
Loved it. It's great.
Let me jump in here, if I may, because somebody texted in and said, I love it when you guys just shoot the blank. Nothing like it. It's a New Orleans tradition. And what we're doing right now, guys, is kind of like a radio crawfish boil, because that's the kind of stuff that goes on. And Ian, that goes to the cultural aspect of what you're talking about. And Dave, with what you do with your family gatherings, that's what makes it so good. I guarantee you, I would bet you the better memories that people have of meals with their families aren't at necessarily a 5-star Michelin, whatever you call it, Ian McNulty, in your world, restaurant, but it's sitting around waiting for the next batch to come out or the crawfish boil or what have you. Agree?
Bingo, yes. And that's the point I was trying to get all the Old Testament ritual and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is a powerful thing because it's the process. The process makes crawfish culture, and culture is the thing that ties us together. You know, there's family bonds and there's cultural bonds, and those are big things. And in Louisiana, we celebrate it through food. And I mean, you can call it a coincidence, you can call it evidence of nature's grand plan or a small miracle or whatever it is, but crawfish come pouring out of the Louisiana harvest areas at precisely the time of year when the weather is the best and the calendar is filled with all of these holidays: Easter, Mother's Day, Father's Day, graduation, spring weddings, all these things I listed before. And it's, you know, crawfish have been available for months. But right now is the peak of the season, the shank of it all. It's the prices have dropped, the quantities are up, the quality is excellent. I've been having crawfish the size of my thumb on a regular. It's excellent right now. And it all syncs up together, and these things are not to be taken for granted or just thought, so the way it always is. They don't do this in other places, fellas. They do not.
And Ian's got a big thumb. He used to be a professional hitchhiker. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I did not know that.
It's rare to get a thumb joke worked in, but I found a way to do it.
Is there any equivalent elsewhere that you've ever experienced, Ian, like the crawfish boil here in Louisiana? I know they do fish boils up in Door County, Michigan, but it's not the same.
They got clam bakes or lobsters in the Northeast. Well, Ian's from Rhode Island originally.
Yeah, right. So the New England clam bake is similar in its shape, but not in its usage. I grew up in Rhode Island and spent a lot of time in New England, and it's a great ritual, but it's not the kind of thing that people mount on the regular like we do down here. It's a much more like, oh, maybe you know somebody who does one once a year and you hope to get invited. It's not, I mean, the crawfish here is inescapable. You know, it's everywhere. You hear it. You can hear the gas jets over your neighbor's fence. You can smell the lemon and clove rising and mingling with the jasmine that's in bloom. I mean, it's everywhere, and I'm here for it. You know, cheers to the brewery tap rooms too that have found symbiosis with the pop-up mobile boilers to do like outdoor family-friendly boils. You know, sometimes you don't want to do it yourself, right? Sometimes you want somebody else to put out the spread. But that being said, the highest expression of this culture is the backyard boil. It is the generosity of somebody hosting this thing. It is the teamwork that goes into it. And it is the rituals and traditions that accrue around it.
And somebody texts in, a lot of boiling seafood is so expensive, you can't afford to disappoint the fam. Think the toughest part of the equation is not over-salting the seafood to get it good and tasty without being too salty. And the same can be said of pepper, where you don't just want it to, you know, we got to take a break here. Y'all hear the orchestra. Dave, you're welcome to stay if you want. Ian McNulty will be here when we come back. Hopefully I will too, unless you've heard something. Tommy Tucker back in a flash. Good Friday morning here on WWL. It is currently 9:30, Good Friday morning. Somebody texted in and said, let me get to the Oquinar Jeweler talking text line here, 504-260-1870. Text, data, message rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Dave, you got to say that. I don't know if you've had your training yet or not, but you're supposed to.
You don't
have
to say it every time.
I think you do. Anyway, said that you guys are having more fun to get away with calling it work. Happy Friday, fellas. And it is nice to just sit around and talk for a change with everything that's going on. And then there's this text. Tommy, Ian is right. And Dave, you said the same thing. It's the anticipation while the crawfish are soaking. Everyone can smell the seasoning. The roar of the flame is silenced. The conversation resumes. Anticipation is half the pleasure. Cooling the water is very important, as Kevin Belton said, who was on with us earlier. If the crawfish are overcooked, they are hard to peel, will break apart. Nothing more disappointing than overcooked crawfish. A head of fresh cauliflower soaks up the spice very well, only takes a few minutes. So I would ask you again to text in some of the special things that you put into your crawfish boil. Somebody said boiled eggs.
Yes, yeah, it's good.
Really?
We were just discussing that off air. I'm actually very curious. I've not seen that before, and I don't know how it would work, frankly. I mean, will the seasoning penetrate the shell?
Well, you can't. You would have to put
you got to peel them and throw them back in
for a few minutes, just a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm picturing like a snorkeling bag or something, like a mesh bag with the eggs dunked in. Okay. Yeah. People are putting ramen and other things in there that you want to kind of keep in one place.
I do know this. You don't want to put boudin because you wind up with nothing.
You end up with rice.
It's like
everywhere.
You pull a basket, but where'd it go? What happened?
This does also bring up the side topic of things that you need at a crawfish boil that do not go in the boil, right? Mm-hmm. Because, okay, drinks, of course, cold drinks. But very often, you know, I know people who have mastered their own crawfish boil techniques, and they have to have a certain something on the side that they serve with the crawfish boil. For instance, grilled cheese, right? I know some people who are fanatics for that.
Really?
You have all this crawfish, and then like, you know what? You just need a break. You need to cut the palate. You need to pad the belly a little bit with something that's not crawfish while you're going through all those drinks. grilled cheese sandwiches. Other people, they have to have potato salad on a side table somewhere. So these are other things ancillary to the actual boil that go into the entire boil experience.
Paper towels, gotta have paper towels. Lots of paper towels.
Yeah, you know, shirt, right?
And as we talk about that, I think that Ian McNulty writes for the newspaper, and how often, how many crawfish boils has Ian McNulty appeared at without knowing about it? Where he's on a table staring up at the people that are eating the crawfish, and he doesn't know it.
That's true. This does also bring up another point, which I know is going to sound a tad morbid, but the obituaries. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, I don't think it's intentional, but very often you've got the newspapers spread out, and you've got these pages of obituaries, and you have the crawfish dumped across them, and it's something that I always note when it happens, because here is this memorial of someone's life while we continue to celebrate life in a very Louisiana way.
Yeah, but and also in Louisiana, we also celebrate life at funerals. So
No, but I've been, Ian, to expand on that, I've been to crawfish boils where the obituaries were there, and inevitably one person or the other starts reading them, and that leads to more conversation, and inevitably somebody either knows the person or knows somebody who knew the person, because it's the degrees of separation, right?
That's true. And let's face it, it's not always current news, because people who are, you know, serious about their crawfish boils, they may stockpile that newspaper. So that could be news
for recycling.
Part of the time. That's right.
Where else have you been? Somebody texted in sweat socks. Don't put those in a crawfish boil. That's not.
No.
Have you put raw oysters in? If so, for how long? Guys, either one of y'all ever try that?
No. I don't know if I'd do that. But I would be willing to try it, you know. If it was someone else's gig, I'd try it.
Somebody texted in chicken hearts. I don't know about that, but I know I love chicken livers. I love fried chicken livers. Thoughts on that, guys?
Sign me up for the chicken hearts. Although, chicken hearts off the grill, that's just perfection. But in a boil, yeah, I'd take that. I'd try that in a heartbeat.
I see what he did there. I probably would not.
No?
I know some people who cannot have a crawfish boil without chicken necks, so got to have the chicken necks.
Some said pig's feet. I've never had a pig's foot. Have you ever eaten it?
No, I saw a jar of pig lips yesterday at the grocery store.
Have you had that, Ian?
Of course, the trotters. Yeah, that's a New Orleans specialty. There's one place in particular down in Central City it's on Washington Avenue, and it's just a little takeout seafood place. But they serve up really good pig's feet next to them. I mean, in the boil, it's got the same seasoning as the crawfish. You throw one of those in there. Sometimes if you're doing it at home, they'll break apart, and you got bits of meat cast throughout it. We're getting towards maple leaf crazy boil, wild man, wildlife boil accoutrements at this point, but. Fair game.
Tex comes in and says, I did raw oysters. It's a big no for me. I would think you could only put them in for a second, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, an overcooked oyster quickly turns into an eraser, basically.
Pet peeve of mine is shrimp in too long. To me, shrimp only have to go in for 1 minute. I mean, you put them in, you take them out, they're perfect. If you leave them in, they shrink and they get rubbery.
Once you think they might be done, they're done. Right now, they're done. Take them out.
Somebody texted and said, it's a weird thing growing up. Newspaper's always a standard, but most crawfish boils I go nowadays don't have the newspaper because few people subscribe. No disrespect to you. They get the electronic version.
I
always loved the newspaper more than the trays, because with the trays, because of the angle, the juice runs down your arms to your elbows. Right?
Two thoughts on that. I do love how more Mardi Gras crews now are throwing things that we actually want to keep instead of just the toxic waste that are Mardi Gras beads, which, by the way, I will be like pushing people out of the way to catch those beads in the fever of Mardi Gras. Right. But, you know, when it's all said and done, you don't really want the beads anymore. But if they're throwing things you want, like I have a sock drawer filled with Bacchus socks from this year. Thank you, Bacchus. I needed those. All my socks had little holes in them. But the crews that were throwing crawfish trays, and I've been seeing them in circulation. It's like you go around town, you see people using the koozies that were thrown from a parade. They're wearing their crew of ferret hats proudly, and they're serving crawfish on these crawfish trays that have like the crew emblems on them. And I think that's really cool. Not that I want to see the demise of newsprint as a a medium of civic engagement or of crawfish boils anytime soon, mind you. But the other thing I want you to think about with that, because it snapped into my mind when we talked about digital. Yeah, a lot of people have digital subscriptions to NOLA.com now instead of the paper delivery. Watch what happens at the crawfish boil that you almost see almost nowhere else now. The cell phones stay in the pocket or the purse or the table, because it's the hands-on, spice-stained concentration of it all. It, for once, if only temporarily, breaks the cell phone addiction. You know, the thing could be buzzing, it could be pinging, and, you know, as long as you're not waiting on news from the delivery room, because you went to the crawfish boil instead of waiting for news from the delivery room at the hospital, unless you're waiting for something like that, like, you're probably going to ignore it until you get your fill, relinquish your spot at the table, and have a chance to wash your hands like a surgeon, and then pick up that phone again and check in. And it's one of the few places, I mean, stoplights? Nope, people are on their phone. You know, security guards outside of, you know, armed guards outside of banks while the armored truck's coming in? On their phones. I mean, everywhere. People are just on their phones, except the serious business of the crawfish boil.
That is a great point, but I would add that if you are waiting on a notice from the delivery room, maybe you should be there instead of at the crawfish boil to begin with, right?
Hey, maybe it's your niece.
You know, priorities. Maybe it's yeah, there you go, your niece.
You know, though, that takes us to the whole trend of people, and I think it's more younger people now, wearing rubber gloves.
Well, you know what? Somebody texted in about that. Let's take a break.
And maybe it's so they can take them off and check their phones.
Take a break for traffic. We'll pick it up. Somebody said as they get older, they find themselves wearing gloves. And we usually talk to Ian McNulty about eating and drinking. But this kind of turned into a Good Friday on-air crawfish boil without the crawfish, with just Dave Cohen, our news director, me, Tommy Tucker, and Ian McNulty. Covers food and dining for New Orleans Advocate, the Times-Picayune, all over the place. Just shooting a breeze. If y'all want to get involved, phone lines are open, 504-260-187. If you want to share some kind of crawfish boil secret or tip or something like that, we'll put you on air. We'll talk to you, make you part of the crawfish boil as well. 940, 20 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 947, 13 till 10. We normally talk to Ian McNulty about eating and drinking, and we are. He covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. Dave Cohen, our news director. Had a little bit of time, so he joined in. I know crawfish boils are a big thing for him and his family. And Ian, you wrote about that, and I want to get to some of the other stuff you wrote about.
Oh, sure. Talking about other restaurant stuff?
Yeah, eating and drinking. Because Dave eats and drinks.
Okay, I have to admit, brunch, it's a big topic. Get asked about it a lot. It's a big deal in New Orleans, and I think it's because we have so many tourists, right? Brunch screams, I'm on vacation. I'm having this long meal to start the morning. I'm going to have some drinks.
Frankly,
not that into it. You can call me a brunch skeptic. You know, if it's truly a signature of a restaurant, of course, I'm going to go try it out. But I really, I just love my lazy Sunday, Saturday mornings in bed too much to, like, bound out of bed to get in line with a bunch of tourists for some rendition of grits and eggs. You know, it just doesn't thrill me.
Wow.
But
that said a lot.
I know, but I saw a brunch menu, a special, that had me bounding out of the house and making a reservation for it, and there was no eggs in sight, no pan perdu to be found, not a hint of hollandaise. It was a dim sum brunch at this uptown restaurant called Mr. Mao. It's on Chapultepec Street. A lot of people will remember the location was formerly Dick and Jenny's. It was Dick and Jenny's restaurant forever, near Tipitina's. And this is a restaurant. It's hard to pigeonhole. The dinner menu is a little bit Indian, a little bit Mexican, a little bit Southeast Asian, sometimes all in one dish. It's pretty wild, actually. It's a really fun, fierce, good place. If you like spice, they got your number. But I had never been to their brunch before, and it's all dim sum style. Now, it's not traditional dim sum necessarily, but it's dim sum, and you know, I'm talking about, you say dim sum, you're thinking dumplings and little rolls.
I'm thinking dim sum good dumplings.
Yeah,
dim sum good dumplings. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
This is a little different. I mean, they have a lot of dumplings and egg rolls, but it's a little more creative. It's not quite your traditional dim sum. But they have this brunch menu of it, and they have a screaming deal where they basically fill the table with plates, like six different plates, to share for two people, and it's $50 for brunch. And that's not $50 each, but for both. And I just thought, I got to try this. So we bounded out of the house recent Sunday, gave it a go, said, just feed me, basically. Give me the set menu. And out it came, delivered on a little cart, and it filled the table. And we watched the room fill up with people who were clearly out for brunch. You know, it was the survivors of a bachelorette party tumbling out of the rideshare van with their Sunday morning hair. It was, you know, a couple people who looked like they're on the mend from Saturday night. And, you know, another sure marker of brunch, there are drinks, right? Mm-hmm. That's what makes brunch qualifiably different from breakfast, usually.
Bloody Marys, mimosas.
Right. There's
old fashions.
I had a cocktail. I fully intended to stick with coffee and some soft drinks. I had some plans for later in the day. They were going to call for a wine happy hour. No reason to rush into things. But I like to meet restaurants where they are. And this one had a particularly appealing cocktail list, and who was I to ignore it? And it started off with one drink that had Malort right at the beginning. Malort is that intensely bitter, I call it the truth serum of Chicago. It's this almost this cult hit amongst bartenders, an acquired taste for some, an absolute no-go for others. But here was this brunch menu leading with a cocktail with Malort. I was like, that's throwing down a gauntlet. I got to pick it up. And I got to say, it was a tight-run thing there, whether alcohol or caffeine was going to carry the day. At the end, it was a draw. It turned out it was a draw for me. But I felt like a big winner because we had this brunch that was a screaming good deal, lots of different flavors. And for once, I had leftovers from brunch that I actually wanted to have. No one ever wants to take the poached eggs or the hollandaise back and eat again after a brunch. Just don't. It's just not going to do it. But in this case, it was. So the Mr. Mao dim sum brunch, it's a great introduction to what they're doing there in general. It's a fantastic restaurant, very modern and different and fresh. And I love that we have restaurants like that percolating in the New Orleans restaurant scene amongst all the traditional born and bred New Orleans, Louisiana type of places that we have.
Although I will say Chef Jean-Luc Albin from Maurice's French Pastries made a Eggs Benedict King Cake for me that I took home, and I managed to keep the poached eggs and eat them for about a week by using the defrost feature on a microwave so it would warm it but not cook the egg yolk.
And sometimes I worry about you, yeah. Tommy. I truly sometimes worry about you.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of work.
Well, but it was good. It was very good. Real quick, I want to get to this real quick with both of y'all before we let you go. And that is, Ian, you alluded to this earlier. When you go to a restaurant, if you go to a seafood place, would you get steak? If you go to a steak place, would you order seafood, or do you have to go with what they do? Dave, you go first.
I always ask, what is your best? You know, what best seller, and what do you? And I ask the server what they think their favorite meal is there, and I'm typically going to go with what they feel like they do the best.
Ian,
you can read the room. Restaurants are telling you what they are. And if it's a seafood place, that should be pretty clear. If it's a steakhouse, of course, that salmon's on there just for the person who got dragged along to the steakhouse dinner. But there are exceptions. Pesh Seafood Grill. It says seafood in the name. It is a seafood restaurant. And yet everything that comes off of that grill, the chicken, the steak, the skewers, it's fantastic. So, you know, sometimes I didn't think that the beef tartare at a seafood restaurant was going to be my favorite beef tartare in town. But that's true at Pesh, the Donald Link restaurant downtown. So I go with read the room, go with what they're telling you they are, but always be open for a new flavor.
One thing I do notice is that, and we got to go because Newell's coming up, but whenever you ask a waiter or a waitress about an item, you can read their face sometimes more than their lips, and they'll tell you about what to stay away from. Agree, guys, or not?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you never get that off of a delivery app either. There's nothing like being there in person, people. Yep. Be there, experience, show up.
This
Love
was
you,
fun.
Everybody. Have a great high holidays of crawfish. Cheers to all who celebrate, and I can't wait. Special shout out to my friend Mike Kerrigan, who's hosting one today, and I'm going to try to get over there and squeeze some lemons over those tails to be soon.
Do that. Cheers. Have a good time in the car park.
Go Team Pineapple.
Ian McNulty, Dave Cohen, thank you. Back in a flash, we'll see what Newell's got planned for us today on WWL.